Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
In the Associated Press article, there's an interview with somebody who went to one of these training camps to train the soldiers there. And their description of the camp, of the camps, are like very dire. You know, there's like no running water, like the soldiers like didn't have any food or equipment. And it just it paints a picture of like a really, terrible place to be, these camps, right? And not the sort of place where you're training a force, an elite force that will topple a government.
You're listening to War College, a weekly podcast that brings you the stories from behind the front lines.
Hello and welcome to War College. I am your host, Matthew Galt. This week, listeners, how not to plan a coup in Venezuela. On May 3rd, American mercenaries and Venezuelan expatriates attempted to enter the country with the goal of overthrowing the Maduro regime. It didn't go well. With us today is Giancarlo Fiorella. Fiorella is an investigator and journalist who's been covering the story at Bellingcat. His May 5th and 7th articles at Bellingcat demand to be read if you want to understand the weird comedy of errors that is currently playing out in Venezuela right now. Giancarlo, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, I don't even know where to start, really. What is Operation Gideon?
Sure, yeah. So Operation Gideon is an attempt by a group of expatriate Venezuelan soldiers, as well as members of a U.S. company called Silver Corps USA, to, as far as we can tell, capture President Maduro of Venezuela and other high-ranking members of the Venezuelan government and take them out of Venezuela, so fly them to the United States, and to effectively, in doing that, topple the Venezuelan government.
And how did that work out for them? How far did they get?
Well, I guess the short answer is that not very far. I should say, though, that we don't know that there is any direct involvement from the U.S. government on this. So the research that we've done so far doesn't point in that direction. We know for sure that there is a private company called Silver Corps USA that had provided security at some Trump rallies. Which in itself isn't suspicious or indication of any sort of collaboration beyond just a financial one at certain rallies, because we know that Trump employs different and lots of different security companies. And so we know that that organization was involved in a plot by Venezuelan people who live in Colombia, to infiltrate Venezuela, as I said, and attempt to remove Maduro from power. So that operation played out starting, as far as we can tell, starting on Sunday, May 3rd. And there was two waves that came in two boats, and both of them were located by the Venezuelan authorities at sea. They were intercepted, and 8 people were killed. Now over 24 people have been arrested in connection to this operation.
No, that's a good point. I do want to make that clear up at the top and maybe change my framing in recording later. We don't know to what extent, if any extent at all, America has played a part in this. On the surface, just my surface read of it, is it does just feel like this absurd set of circumstances that are just playing out in public and are very embarrassing all around, for Silver Corps USA in particular.
Yeah, there has been reporting that, so Jack Murphy is an individual who wrote an article shortly after this all came to light, and it's been reported in other media outlets as well that it's possible that the CIA knew about this plot, at least on the Silver Corps USA side. I also read a report, I believe it was in the Washington Post, that said that the CIA had sat in on a couple of meetings leading up to this, presumably between Silver Corps USA and sectors of the Venezuelan opposition. And as Jack Murphy reported, the CIA supposedly attempted to talk the people involved in this at Silver Corps from doing it. And apparently that didn't work.
Jack Murphy, is he the AP reporter that's been hitting this?
No, I know. So that's Joshua Goodman. So yeah, Joshua Goodman has done exceptional reporting on this. In fact, he wrote an article on May 1st that kind of brought it all to light even before it started. He sort of introduced Jordan Goodreau, who's the head of Silver Corps USA, to this whole story. And he's writing for the Associated Press. So yeah, if you also want to read up on some really good reporting on this, even prior to the attempt on May 3rd, Joshua Goodman's work on the Associated Press is really good.
Okay, yeah, this begs a question, and I think we don't have the timeline confused here, audience. This is what happened. AP publishes this very long, extensive, well-reported story on the 1st about this, about Silver Corps, and about Jordan in particular, who I think is just this amazing character that we'll get into in a minute. And then they still go forward with everything on the 3rd?
That's part of what makes this so confusing. So as you said, on May 1st, Joshua Goodman publishes this really thorough piece on the Associated Press. And he basically says, look, there is a group of Venezuelan expatriate soldiers in Colombia, and they're headed by this guy called Cleaver Alcala. He's a well-known figure in Venezuela. It was reported previously that he was in Colombia. We knew last year that he was attempting to organize something like a mercenary force in Colombia that would potentially carry out some kind of military operation in Venezuela. So those rumors have been around for a while. That reporting has been around for a while. And then Joshua Goodman's piece introduced, as he said, Jordan Goodreau to this. So if you read, and I recommend that you do read Joshua Goodman's piece from May 1st, he says, okay, so there's this sort of fomenting mercenary kind of army that's growing in Colombia under the auspices of this Cleaver Alcala guy. And then now there's this other guy, his name is Jordan Goodreau, and he introduces Silver Corps USA, and he's a former Green Beret, and he had this agreement with Alcala and the Venezuelan opposition to train these soldiers that would eventually lead this mission into Venezuela. And what's fascinating about the article, I mean, aside from everything, like all of the details in it, is that you get the impression as you're reading it that nobody really believed that this could go ahead. So like nobody involved thought it was a good idea, beyond whatever Goodreau was trying to sell because he was trying to make money. You get the impression step by step that the opposition kind of gets the sense that Goodreau maybe is not all there, that this isn't really a good idea. How are you going to infiltrate the country? And so when you get to the end of the article, you're left thinking, certainly as I was left thinking, you know, thank goodness this never happened, because this would have been the worst idea ever. And sure enough, 2 days later, we wake up on Sunday morning and we're hearing reports from Venezuela of an invasion from the sea, that there's a boat that's been intercepted. And it was the plan. It got kicked off 2 days after the publication of this article, which is one of the many weird turns that this has taken, is the fact that the operation went ahead at all after that publication.
And that they tweeted about it. Silver Corps USA tweeted about it on the 3rd.
Yeah. So what happened was on the 3rd, we wake up and I see very early on in the morning, probably about 9 o'clock in the morning, there's been a press conference by the Minister of the Interior of Venezuela. And he says, we've intercepted a ship of terrorist mercenaries that they were coming over to invade Venezuela and to topple the government. And I don't think he announced that anybody had died, but I think they eventually came out throughout the day that some of them had been killed and that others have been arrested. And I remember thinking when that came out, that's really weird. It sounds like that's what the article from 2 days ago was talking about, but surely it couldn't be that, because you know, like, why would you launch the invasion or whatever you want to call this incursion when you have maximum visibility, when literally the entire world now knows of your plans? So I thought that the Venezuelan government maybe had, you know, maybe they had arrested a drug trafficking network, or you know, they had intercepted a drug shipment, and there'd been a firefight, and they were trying to paint this as like this invasion force that you read about 2 days ago. But then what happened later that day on Sunday was that Jordan Goudreau appeared on video alongside a Venezuelan cohort. And he said, this was us. So that thing that you read about this morning about the government intercepting that ship, that was us. That was the incursion that we had been planning that you read about. It's called Operación Gedeón. And it's going to, and he very clearly sort of says, like, we're going to capture Maduro. It's ongoing. You know, one ship was intercepted, but there's more coming. And it just seemed completely bizarre, completely surreal. And as you said earlier, on Sunday night, the Silvercore USA account tweets. It says there's a strike force on its way to Venezuela. It's got 60 people on a boat, and two of them are former Green Berets. So that's the entire message. So I went to sleep on Sunday thinking, okay, this has been the weirdest day, I think, that I can remember of covering Venezuelan events. And surely this isn't, like, there is no boat. Like, this tweet is a mistake. Like, there's something else going on here. Like, this is a joke or something. But no, the next day we found out that, yeah, two U.S. citizens had been arrested aboard a boat, and the tweet was real. It was alerting the world. It was telling everybody that this was ongoing. So we know that he was a Green Beret in the U.S. military, and that he served in Afghanistan and Iraq. And again, based on the reporting that we've heard from the Associated Press and other publications, he was, like, well regarded by people who served with him. So he had a pretty, you know, he had a military career that ended with, he was awarded the Bronze Star a few times. And then in 2018, he set up this company, this private security company called Silvercore USA. And he was known back when this company started, he had this idea to place like undercover special forces soldiers, like former veterans, in schools with weapons, so that the idea was that if you had, like, highly trained soldiers in schools, like, pretending to be teachers, you know, nobody would attack schools. Like, there would be no more school shootings. And if there were, you had these, like, highly trained soldiers who would be able to respond at the drop of a hat. So there were some reports early on, you know, back in 2018, 2019, that mentioned that initiative that he had launched. And we also know that he, again, provided security at some Trump events. So in the first article that we published, and Bellingcat, we found some footage of him in the background of Trump rallies, sort of, you know, working security. So as far as we can tell, you know, he's a person who served in the military, and who came out of the military, and he, you know, he must have sat down and thought, what can I do now that I'm out of the army? You know, what am I good at? What could I do? And he decided he was going to try to set up a company, and eventually that led him to signing a contract with the Venezuelan opposition to, you know, carry out this operation.
Not all special operations forces members, former or otherwise, are cut from the same cloth. It's why, you know, just like any other group, there's a wide variety. Do we have any sense of what this gentleman was like from people that worked with him, the people who served with him? What do they say about him? Also, where is he right now? Do we have any idea?
So he's still communicating with the media, because every once in a while you'll see something published in the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal, and Ellie will cite him. He'll say, like, you know, we were on the phone with him and he said this, right? The company was founded in Florida, so I believe he lives in Florida. As far as I'm aware, he's still there. The Associated Press reported a few days ago that he might be under investigation for weapon smuggling. You know, I think that's maybe one of the many charges that he could potentially be facing, right? But as far as I'm aware, he's in Florida. And, you know, again, this is based on reporting that I've read about him. And in particular, the report from May 1st from Joshua Goodman. You know, people say he's the kind of guy, I'm paraphrasing somebody's commentary on him. He's the sort of the guy that you wanted to be with in combat, like the kind of guy you want to have in a foxhole with you. He was a really good shot, apparently. He was just a really motivated soldier. But then there's also a testimony from people who say that he was, you know, he sort of got in way over his head with this whole idea about the mercenary force. You know, maybe he was an overzealous entrepreneur who like dreamt way too big, right? And he just kind of bit off more than he could chew. But from everything that I've read, from people who said that they knew him, he was somebody who was a good a soldier, you know, by the standards of a soldier.
Okay. Earlier you'd said that there was a sense from people on the ground that like he couldn't pull this off and this thing was not going forward. What are you based, like, where are you getting that from?
So we know, so there's a couple of things here. So the first one is again, reporting from the Associated Press, that says that people, so this agreement that Goodrow allegedly had with the opposition was that, he would train Venezuelan expatriate soldiers in camps in Venezuela. And these camps had already been hinted at in previous reporting from 2018 and 2019 related to this figure, Cleaver Alcalá. He was a major general in the Venezuelan army, and he was a lifelong Chavez supporter. He served with Chavez in the 1992 coup, and he was in the military during the Chavez era. When Maduro came to power, he kind of fell out with grace from the government, and he eventually moved to Colombia, and he became a very vocal detractor of the government, a very vocal dissident. So Alcalá had been working on setting up something like a mercenary army or an expatriate army that was built on the soldiers who were essentially deserting from Venezuela in droves, right? So you have to remember also the backdrop for this is the Venezuelan exodus, which is, you know, the largest migration wave out of the country in the nation's history, right? We're talking about, you know, millions of Venezuelans fleeing the country due to poor socioeconomic conditions there. So there were lots and lots of soldiers. There are lots and lots of soldiers in Colombia who Alcalá was trying to tap into this force that they could then use to fight their way back into Venezuela and overthrow the government, right? Like a really big dream. So in the Associated Press article, there's an interview with somebody who went to one of these training camps to train the soldiers there. And their description of the camps are like very dire. You know, there's like no running water, like the soldiers like didn't have any food or equipment. And it just doesn't, I mean, it paints a picture of like a really, you know, terrible place to be, these camps, right? And not the sort of place where you're training a force, an elite force that will topple a government. So that's one factor that leads us to think that this thing wasn't really going to work out and that these camps and that this training program really wasn't going to be effective. The other is the fact that we've heard both from Goodrow and from the opposition that despite the fact that they signed a contract that was worth $213 million, the opposition never really paid Goodrow any money. So Goodrow said, look, I can do this for you. Like I can train your soldiers to launch this operation, but I'm going to need all this money. And we know that at least two opposition figures signed a contract with Silvercorp USA saying, yes, let's do it. But they immediately, like they never paid him. They didn't even pay the retainer, the $1.5 billion retainer that Goodrow had asked for. And so almost immediately after, like the ink wasn't dry in the contract, Goodrow wasn't getting any support from the opposition, like any monetary support. And so this is back in October, November of last year. So right off the bat, this operation lacks any kind of logistics, any kind of support, and it's just doomed to fail from the very beginning. And in fact, as the Venezuelan opposition claims, it was never even supposed to go ahead. Like they never even gave it the go ahead because, again, it was clear to a lot of people that it was not going to work.
Do we know if Goodrow was ever on the ground in Venezuela, like actually there in person for any
in Venezuela?
In Colombia, rather. I'm sorry.
Yes, in Colombia, yes. So again, this is based on the AP report reporting that he was in Colombia to have meetings with both Alcalá and members of the Venezuelan opposition, other members of the Venezuelan opposition. And he went there. I mean, it was essentially a business trip where he would just go and, you know, like he was selling a service, right? He's like, you know, who needs somebody to train soldiers? Because I could do that.
All right. And he's not the only Green Beret involved, right?
That's correct. So we know also that there are two other individuals. So their names are Luke Denman and Aaron Berry. And they're both also former Green Berets who are currently under custody. They're in detention in Venezuela. And there's been two, confession videos, quote unquote, because they're obviously propaganda pieces. They're heavily edited, like they jump forward and backwards in time. You can tell they're sort of being coerced into reading statements, right? And they're currently in Venezuela right now. Like they're prisoners of the Maduro government, accused of being mercenaries, trying to overthrow the government.
All right, let's back up a little bit. Can you give me kind of the blow-by-blow timeline of what we know of the actual operation?
Yeah, so we know that there was that the Venezuelan authorities detected a boat off the coast of Venezuela, north of a place called Macuto, in the early morning hours of Sunday, before the sun had come up. We know that there are videos on Twitter showing police helicopter activity or military helicopter activity out at sea and vessel activity out at sea. And you can hear shooting in these videos. So we know that that's the time when this boat was intercepted. Again, that was very early in the morning. At about 7:30 on Sunday, the Minister of the Interior makes his press conference and he says, we've arrested these people who were trying to invade Venezuela. As the morning passes, we start to get images shared by Venezuelan journalists of the equipment and the weapons that the authorities claim to have seized as part of this operation. And they included things like assault rifles. There was two vehicles that were waiting for them allegedly on shore that had machine guns on them. Just the sort of equipment that I guess you would, if you were an armed group, like you would use those sort of things, right? Sunday afternoon, we've got confirmation from Goudreau and his Venezuelan cohort that this incursion really was a part of Operación Gedeon, and that there was more. So they keep hinting at more. Like there's more people coming. We have more people being deployed. Goudreau, in his very first video, says, I'm paraphrasing. He says something like, "We have men in the west and the east and the south, and they're sort of converging on Caracas." Right. So he's painting this picture of like this larger operation that's going on, and that only this small force was intercepted. Sunday night, we get the tweet from Silvercore USA saying, "Stay tuned. If you're the Venezuelan government, there's more people coming." There's a strike force underway, I think he says, 60 Venezuelans and two former Green Berets. On Monday, early afternoon, we get confirmation via images of a second boat that has been intercepted. And this one was intercepted near north of a place called Chuao, which is just a little bit west of Macuto. And it was a very similar story. The boat was intercepted at sea. There's footage of people on this boat from a helicopter, raising their arms in the air, surrendering to the authorities. And they were brought ashore by the Venezuelan authorities. There's images of them with their hands behind their back after they were detained. And this is the group to which Luke and Aaron belonged. And so they were taken to Caracas, where they, I believe they're still in Caracas right now in custody. And then after Monday, we're occasionally hearing news of more people getting arrested in connection to this. Now, I should say that whenever the Venezuelan government has said, like, oh, we've arrested two more people related to this, we've arrested three more people related to this, we don't know for sure. I mean, we have to take the Venezuelan government at their word, and I would advise against doing that just based on the track record of the Venezuelan government. And the images that they present of people that they've arrested supposedly in connection to Operación Gedeon don't really seem to indicate that that would be the case necessarily. And I'm saying specifically that, in these images, we see people like wearing, shorts and like T-shirts who have been arrested. Like they're indistinguishable from any other sort of person who might be arrested for like a drug crime or something. So what I'm saying is that we don't see anything in the images that the Venezuelan government has been releasing since these two boats were intercepted that would suggest that these individuals are involved with Operación Gedeon. But since Monday, over two dozen have been implicated and arrested.
Right. That's one of the things that's hard to track about this story is that it's hard. How do you report on something like this when you can't trust the Venezuelan government, you can't trust Silvercore USA. How do you put this story together? How do you track all of it?
Yeah. So one of the things I think that Bellingcat is known for is for sticking to the facts, right? So whenever we're reporting on something, we need to be careful that we talk only about what we know based on the facts. So, you know, we're not sort of, you know, we could speculate whether or not the people that have been arrested allegedly by the government are related to Operación Gedeón or not. But, you know, if we were reporting that, you would caveat that by saying, like, you know, this is an allegation that the Venezuelan government has made, right? And this is the allegation, right? But as far as putting the stories together, the first two, you know, we're looking at what can we see in the images? What is obvious from the pictures? What can we sort of, take from not just what the Venezuelan government's saying, but what from other sources are saying, right? So that eventually you're hopefully able to like triangulate something that approximates the truth, that isn't just, based on one side's description of it, right? So a really good example of that is, again, when the Venezuelan government said on Sunday morning, we've arrested terrorist mercenaries, right? You know, you ask yourself, like, where's the evidence, right? Like, show me, like, why do you say that they're Venezuelan, that they're terrorist mercenaries, right? Later on that day, we start to see pictures of weapons, of other military equipment coming from Venezuelan journalists, right? And so as that information begins to trickle in, you can start to sort of corroborate what were at first independent data points and build a more complete picture that you can say, okay, this is probably something that happened, right? So it's a pretty lengthy process. And one that is, I think, difficult to navigate. But it's the sort of thing that takes like slow thinking and like double checking always, like, your assumptions, like, what am I assuming here?
Right. You don't want to be the publication that rushes out. I mean, God bless the Associated Press and the amazing story they published on the first, but you don't want to be the first to press with the headline that ends up being completely wrong. Right. Especially if you're and Bellingcat does things a little bit differently than most mainstream outlets, I think. And I mean that in a positive way.
Thanks. Yeah. And I think that we actually were pretty quick with these stories. So, you know, there's the two different kinds of, you know, if you had to divide Bellingcat stories into two, you know, there would be like the long form, like, we've spent 2 years analyzing these pictures and this is what we can tell from them. And then there is a shorter sort of like, the sort of stuff that you see, for example, from Robert Evans after there's a mass shooting that's connected to like 4chan or 8chan, for example. And those are more like, pieces that are like, look, this is what we know. And this is what it's on the, this is what we, it's on the internet. What we can verify is true. And you know, there's lots of questions that we don't know the answer to. There's lots of questions that we haven't asked yet because it's so early on, but this is what we do know. And here's the evidence, right? So even the pieces that come out pretty quickly after something has happened, tend to stick to that, right? Like, this is what we know from the evidence and here's the evidence. You can sort of look at it yourself.
All right. What do we know anything else about who these Green Berets are? The ones that are in captivity at the moment.
So both of them had social media profiles. Mm-hmm. As investigators, not just Bellingcat, but lots of people who are, you know, you don't have to be an investigator at an organization to do this. You can just, you know, look their names up on Facebook and see what they were up to. We know that at least Barry served in Germany at some point. I think he was actually arrested with his German driver's license, if I'm not mistaken, which was one of the pieces of identification that he had with him. And we also know, again, that they the information that they provided via these videotaped confessions that you can see on Venezuelan media. Now, again, a huge caveat there, because these are, you know, this isn't a confession that you would see like in a courtroom that was carried out with like the person's lawyer at hand, right? These are meant to be propaganda pieces. So when you watch these confessions, you know, Luke and Aaron are providing answers to these questions, but you can, you know, some of the questions are very clearly like propaganda based, right? Like, so they're asked a lot like, why, you know, how would you feel if somebody invaded the United States? Like, what would you do, right? And so if you, you know, if you watch those interviews carefully, you might be able to glean some information about like what kind of people they are. But again, I would advise against taking the information in those interviews at face value because they've been heavily edited. You know, I'm sure they were coerced and again, they're propaganda pieces above anything else.
Yeah, something I think that's important to keep in mind whenever we talk about stuff like this, and I think we do a good job of this on this show, is that sometimes a story can have more than one asshole.
Yeah.
Right? Like both sides of a thing can be bad. In different nuanced ways.
Yeah.
Right.
No, okay, sure. I mean, I was asked this, recently. I think this is one of those situations where, you know, there is no necessarily a good guy in this. One of the things that I'm afraid of is that this is not just related to this event, but so I'm from Venezuela. I grew up there and I have a lot of family there. And, the Venezuelan situation has shaped my life. I haven't lived there in 25 years, but my entire professional career, like from being a graduate student 10 years ago to being a doctoral candidate now to work in Bellingcat, has really been shaped by Venezuela. I care deeply about it. Partially because some of my family still lives there, and not a day goes by that I don't think about Venezuela, and I don't feel terrible for what's happening there. So I'm afraid that people who are not very familiar with the Venezuela, who maybe never heard of it or who just don't know anything about what's happening there, will read what happened. Like they'll see what happened there and they'll say, oh, wow, clearly these U.S. guys are terrible and bad. And so that means, like, by definition, if those are the bad guys, then by definition, the Venezuelan government is the good guy. And I should cheer for the Venezuelan government. Or, you know, I should like vocally defend it and on social media and stuff. Right. And I don't think that's the case. I think, as you're saying, like this is a case where both sides are bad, you know they both have done things that they should be condemned for. But it's much more complicated than like who's the good guy and who's the bad guy.
Right. And can you tell us a little bit more about the opposition? What the reaction to all of this has been, and like has there been any kind of political fallout for them because of it?
Yeah. Like speaking of like all the bad actors involved in this, right? So it's not just Silvercorp USA. It's also the Venezuelan opposition because they in a way helped to precipitate this by engaging Guaidó. So you might be familiar with Juan Guaidó, who is the leader of the opposition at the moment. And so this is another part of the story that's kind of really confusing. Jordan Guaidó released a document on Sunday that had his signature and the signature of two opposition politicians, last names Rendon and Vergara. And it also had Juan Guaido's signature. And this was, he said it was a contract. It's like, this is the contract that we signed for this incursion, right? And as you can see, and he held it up, this is Juan Guaido's signature and Vergara's signature and Rendon's signature and my signature.
And this is the subject of your May 7th story, correct?
Is this
document?
Yes.
Okay.
And then, but here's where it gets tricky, because a few days later, the Washington Post published a 41-page document that appears to be the attachments. It appears to be sort of like a longer version of that original document or an attachment to that original document. And that attachment, the 41-page attachment, has very clearly spells out like, this is, you know, these are the rules of engagement. This is what a protected building is. This is what happens when we detain Venezuelan citizens. These are the weapons that we can use. It's like a document that you would draft if you're like, you know, going to invade a country, right? As a private military company. And that document does not have Guaido's signature on it. But it has the signatures of the other two opposition representatives. So the messaging from the opposition on this has been really confused. Because you have Guaidó and the opposition saying, look, you know, they'll say, look, both documents are falsified by the government because they're supposed to, like, they want to trick everybody into thinking I signed this. But then you have both Vergara and Rendon saying, no, we signed that document, but we don't know how Guaidó's signature got on the other one. So it's a super, it's like a, soup of like super confused narratives that can boil down to, you know, we did sign one document with Goudreau and Silvercore USA, but that was an exploratory document, is what the opposition's saying. And we stopped talking to Goudreau in November of 2019, and we told him, forget about it. We're not going to do this anymore. Like, this is over, right? That's as coherent as an explanation as I can give you about the opposition stance on this. Now, why would you, like, why would they sign the document and then tell them, you know what, forget it? Because, you know, by signing it, you're sort of like, you know, you signed a contract with somebody, right? So, like, why would you, like, why didn't they not say, let me read the document and then I'll tell you if we can go ahead with it or not? And if we can go ahead, I'll sign it, you know? So far, Guaido has survived this. He has not been arrested, which is something that a lot of people were expecting, I think, because this is the closest that he's been connected to like a legitimate coup to overthrow Maduro. But he's still free. He's still the head of the opposition, although he's taken a huge hit, I think, in people's confidence in him. So I don't know what the next few weeks look like, but I would be surprised if he is still the leader of the opposition by this time next year.
Well, and a bunch of his advisors have resigned. His aides and advisors Correct. Have resigned, right?
Yeah, including the two who signed the document. So Vergara and Rendon resigned yesterday, right? Like, they're saying, like, yeah, we signed this document. Clearly, it was a mistake. So, you know, like, sorry, we're leaving, right? And then the official opposition news portal, press portal released a statement saying, like, yes, you know, they've resigned. We thank them for their service and we, you know, accept their resignation. Like, just like the most generic statement. But I think this is, you know, people have been looking to Guaido for leadership, obviously as a leader of the opposition. And whatever popularity he had at the start of his tenure as a leader, and he was very popular at first, I think has really diminished over the years. Largely part of because he hasn't been able to deliver a victory over the Maduro government. And I don't know. I mean, I don't think he'll be able to recover for this. Like, as low as his popularity was and the level of confidence was with among Venezuelan people before this, I think this is going to leave a really dark mark in his record. And I don't know if he'll survive it.
All right. We're going to pause there for a break. You are listening to War College. We are talking about the coup that went wrong in Venezuela.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
All right, listeners, welcome back to War College. We are on talking about Venezuela and the coup that went wrong. Let me ask you a tangent question.
Yeah.
Do people like Maduro? Like, Chavez, I get it. Like, I understood him. You know, he was a very charismatic figure, and yeah. But Maduro is not. Yeah. Like, how does he maintain support?
Yeah, so the short answer is that no, he's a deeply unpopular figure, and it's there's a lot of factors for that. Chief amongst them is the fact that Chavez was charismatic, and he was a leader. Like, he had leadership ability, right? And he had the characteristics of a leader. Like, he had a commanding presence. You know, he had a long military record, and just people listened to him, right? I was talking to a Venezuelan friend once, and I was, you know, asking him, this is early on in the Maduro presidency, what he thought about Maduro and like how he compared to Chavez. And he told me, he said, you know, if one day we went to the supermarket and there wasn't milk, you know, if there was a milk shortage, you would watch TV that night and Chavez would be on TV and he would be angry. He would say, why is there no milk in the country? Where's the minister of milk? Like, who, you know, who's responsible for this? And he would call them up and the next day there would be milk in the supermarket, right? Like Chavez would say, I order that there be milk in the supermarket tomorrow. And he says with Maduro, the same thing happens and you go back to the supermarket and there's like fewer milk. There's less milk than there was yesterday, right? So, he's sort of a bumbling, you know, he's not, as you said, he's not Chavez. Why is he in power? Why does he continue to be in power? Largely because he has the support of the military and in particular the sort of from the mid-level up of the army. Military support is everything to Maduro. The Minister of Defense is an incredibly powerful figure in the country. There are generals, active duty generals, who are in important positions in the country up until just a few weeks ago. A National Guard military officer was the head of like the Minister of Oil and the head of the PDVSA, which is a state-owned oil firm, right? So there's tons of money coming in to the military. The military benefits directly from having Maduro in power, and so they have an interest in keeping him in power. If the military decided that they didn't want to keep him in power anymore or that they didn't support him, he would not have any support.
Is there any kind of military opposition to him within the officers? Like, this is not the same thing because he worked for CICPC, but I think about Oscar Perez in 2017.
Yeah. So these sort of like insurrections that have taken, including the Oscar Perez one, and there's been a couple of other ones throughout the years, they've tended to involve relatively small numbers of individuals and relatively like low ranking, right? So we're talking about, you know, we're not talking about people in positions of power in the military. They tend to be lower level soldiers, right? And it makes sense because they're the ones who, like, the crumbs from the top don't make it all the way to the bottom, right? So while you know, the generals and the admirals and all the high ranking people, they're like directly lining their pockets with, you know, money from having Maduro in power through corruption schemes, drug trafficking, et cetera. You know, your sort of rank and file private isn't benefiting from that necessarily, right? And so those are the kinds of people that will every once in a while get together with a couple of other like-minded individuals and they'll make the news. Like Oscar Perez or like Operation Aurora from last year, from December of last year, where a small group of soldiers raided a couple of military bases in Bolivar State. But those insurrections they've always been small. They've always been isolated. And so they've never really amounted to anything beyond making headlines for a day or two. The only exception is probably Oscar Perez, because he made it a point to sort of like always be in the news cycle, right?
He was a former actor, correct? If I remember correctly.
Yeah.
He had very striking features and was good in front of the camera. Was obviously trying to play that up.
Yes, exactly. So he knew, right. I think he understood like the importance of the media. Yeah. So he was a fascinating figure, including because he was a former actor. So he had an Instagram account that had like really photogenic shots of him, like doing trick shots with his pistol. And just like he was in a movie at some point, as well. And he understood the importance of messaging, right. And of being in the media and sort of like looking good on camera. And so he's an exception to these like small insurrections that take place every once in a while. And then, sort of fizzle out, right? But even his insurrection ended, right? About 6 months after it began. I think that's indication that look, I'm sure there's discontent in the military because there's discontent in Venezuela, right? Like soldiers don't live independent of the rest of society, right? Like they go home at night. They also have family members who don't have access to medicine, who don't have access to food, right? So, there's discontent, but the issue is that there's not discontent necessarily at the levels where you can actually affect some kind of change, right? Which then, you know, are like the middle to higher ranks of the military.
Right, because you have to make sure. I mean, it's in. There's a great book called The Dictator's Handbook. The author's names escape me, but it was basically like these classically trained economists kind of looking at how a dictator stays in power. Who do you have to please? And up at the top of the list is keep the military well-funded and well-fed, and you'll be in power for a very long time. And that seems to be what's going on here, right?
Yeah, as I said, you know, the higher ranks are benefiting directly from Maduro, right? And I mean, this is, we could talk about hours about this, but one of the central pillars of I would argue the Maduro government, the Maduro era, is something called the civil military union, Unión Cívico Militar. This is I guess it's a tenet of Chavismo, of the political philosophy, that calls for an erasing of the boundary between the civilian and the military sphere, right? So, you know, I live in Canada now. If you live in the United States, like you probably have in your head, when you think about the state government, you have an understanding or you have an image of a government that has divisions, right? And one, and there's like the military side of government, and that's very separate from the civilian side of government, right? But in Venezuela, Maduro has really been pushing to remove that imaginary boundary and to give the military much more power over the civil sphere, right? I think, you know, it's a sort of a utopian idea, I guess, because what's supposed to happen is that the civilian sphere is supposed to also have power over the military. But what's happening in Venezuela, it's very much a one-sided relationship. So you have the military have an increasing influence over the civil sphere by being members of cabinet positions, right? For example. And so, that erasure of that boundary also makes it really hard to separate, it makes it harder to address the issue that is the military supporting Maduro, because the military is a lot in Venezuela. The military is everything.
What are the employment numbers for it, out of curiosity? Like, how many people does it employ? You know, that kind of thing.
Oh, for the military? Oh boy, I'd have to look them up. I'm not sure. I know that the militia, so the National Bolivarian Militia, I think Maduro has said that there's over 3 million members of the militia. So these are civilian members of the National Bolivarian Militia, which is a relatively new force. But for the active duty or the reserve military, I'd have to look it up. I'd have to check on that.
Okay, swinging back into our tale of woe here. One of the things that really struck me, and I think you mentioned it in I'm pretty sure you mentioned it in your May 5th article. Looking at this cache of equipment that they were supposedly going to be meeting and using for their coup, there was an airsoft rifle in there.
Yeah.
What? Yeah. Like, which I feel just tells me so much about what was going on.
Yeah. So that was really strange, because there were also real weapons that were captured, right? So it's not like, you know, that was the only gun that was seen that day, and it happened to be an airsoft rifle. So that, you know, that makes it all the more confusing, right? I've heard people speculate online that somebody made a connection between, I think this is somebody who commented on the article in Bellingcat, who said, you know, in the AP article, they talked about how the camps in Colombia where they were training these soldiers, they had like no resources, like nobody. They had no logistical resources, no equipment, and they were training with broomsticks. That was reported in the AP. So they thought, well, maybe this is like one of the guns that they were training with, and they brought it on along with them for some reason. I read somewhere else that somebody was speculating that it might have been used to like take out like light bulbs, you know, like silently. You know, I'm not a tactician. I've never been in the military. I don't know how feasible that is. But it's like another one in a lot of like curveballs that we were all thrown, since the story broke. You know, why was there an air rifle there? I don't know. It was pictured among the equipment that was captured on that day. And then now it's part of the story.
Yeah, I think that's one of the fascinating things about this story is that there's so many curveballs. Like the more you dig and the more you learn about it, it's just so odd, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's more questions that, you know, we were all talking as we were following this. It seemed like at every new revelation was like a moment where we all went like, wait, what? Like, how? And what does that mean? And, you know, why would they do that? Right. Yeah, you know, we don't have answers to a lot of those questions right now, right? And that's why it's, you know, it's it's kind of difficult to talk about this in a certain way because even the facts as we understand them seem to be really absurd, right? So it's hard to cut the what's real and what's not real, because what we know is real is also kind of really absurd. So it's just been a really surreal story to report on.
I mean, we live in absurd times though.
Yeah, right? I guess so. Yeah. I feel like, like the simulation that the universe runs on is like collapsing and it's like consistently like pumping out more and more absurd scenarios. Yeah.
Why, just a couple more questions. I know you've got a heart out here soon.
Sure.
Why is America so obsessed with Venezuela? And I say that it's not just the political right. It is also the political left.
Yeah.
And it's become like a weird it's become something to yell at each other about online. Why?
Yeah. As if we needed more excuses to yell at each other. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a really interesting question. I think Venezuela encapsulates a lot of what we see troubling in the world in terms of politics from a lot of different sides, right? So like if you're on the right or on the left, if you're a right-wing pundit, for example, which, not a lot of people are, thankfully, but if you're like some right-wing pundit on like Fox News, you might be really obsessed with Venezuela because, it's socialism, right? And it's socialism spreading. And if we let socialist Venezuela, if we elect so-and-so here in November, then we're going to become like socialist Venezuela, right? So to some people, Venezuela is something that you can point to and like score a point over someone online. You can say, look, your political philosophy doesn't work. And look at Venezuela, right? Look at how bad it is there. Look at the hospitals. Look at the food, right? If you're on the other side of the aisle, I think Venezuela at some point represented a really hopeful and a really encouraging model for a different way to do govern, right? So this is the very early Chavez era. Chavez came with a really nice message of inclusion of the working of the poor of Venezuela, who had been neglected for so long from the political dialogue, really for decades, right? So Chavez was elected, as he was sort of explicitly saying, like, I'm going to speak to the poor, like I'm going to rule for the poor, I'm going to govern for them. They've been neglected for so long, and that's a nice message, right? Like that's I want governments to do that. And so for a lot of people, I think Venezuela represented like a vision of a better future in a certain way. And so everything that happens there that is negative, you can point to and say, well, it was going well until you got involved, like the U.S. got involved, right? So I think it's there's almost like a Cold War mentality, I think, about Venezuela, where different interests are just fighting, in this case virtually, over what it all means to score political points at home. So it's a bit of a perfect storm, unfortunately, for online debates.
Right. Everyone sees themselves reflected in it and projects their own ideology onto the conflict and has it reflected back at them, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Which is bad, and we should stop doing it, but we're not going to, unfortunately. Giancarlo, thank you so much for coming onto War College and walking us through this bizarre and complicated story.
No, it was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's it for this week, War College listeners. War College is me, Matthew Galt, and Kevin O'Dell. It was created by myself and Jason Fields. If you like the show, please follow us on Twitter @war_college, @MJGalt, and @KJKNodell. We will be back next week with more stories from behind the front lines. Stay safe until then.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.